Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 5th. Today's session is Empowering Images, TV and Social Change, The Courage of Their Convictions, presented by John DeGroff. The number of this series is 2002.01. Let's listen in.
I wanted to just tell you very briefly a little bit about myself and my motivations, because that'll set up the clips from the films that you're going to see tonight and our discussion. My topic is called Empowering Images, TV and Social Change, which for most people will sort of seem like an oxymoron or something to that sort, because I'm sure an awful lot of you feel that television is the greatest block to social change that exists in this country, and you're probably right. But I've had the good luck to be able to work in TV for 25 years now, and to try in some small way to get some different stories out there that I think hopefully can empower us to think differently about our gifts and our talents and what we can do to change society for the better. And the first few films that I actually made were all stories of really remarkable people who had done just that. People inspired by faith, in many cases, or by other ideals, who saw a real problem but didn't stick their head in the sand, but in fact went out and tried to do something about it, and succeeded in many cases, at least to some degree, although they were often up against overwhelming odds. I had watched a lot of documentaries even before I got into television in 1977, actually in Minneapolis, and I appreciated documentaries very much, but it seemed like most of the ones that you saw about social issues were really very great in kind of pointing out a problem and all of its ramifications and just how bad things were. But you kind of got done watching these documentaries and you went, oh, you know, basically, well, eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow you die or something. But the whole feeling was there wasn't much sense that you could do anything. And on the other hand, I had met people that I really saw doing something, and so I wanted to tell stories about some of those people that would leave viewers understanding that real problems do exist that need to be confronted. There are real troubles out there, but that that each of us can do something to make a difference in solving some of those things. And one of the first films that I had a chance to work on was a story of three remarkable women who were farm women living on farms in Minnesota. This was in the very early 1980s, 1981, in fact, when the farm crisis was perhaps at its most severe, and farms were really going out of business right and left. Small farmers were being squeezed, couldn't make it. This kind of situation, of course, continues to this day, but maybe it was at its peak at that particular time. And I profiled three women who were trying to fight that, who were farm women who wanted to stay with their families on the land and continue to farm. And one of those, the first of those, was a woman very active in the Lutheran Church, and whose husband was also very active in the church, named Ann Canton. And I don't know, anybody in this room know Ann Canton? I bet some of you do. Ann later became the Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture in the state of Minnesota, but that was somewhat down the line. And I found Ann a very inspiring individual, just an ordinary farm woman who was pushed by circumstances, and in Ann's case by her faith, to go out and do something to try to change the situation that she and her family found themselves confronted with. So the first clip I'm going to show you is from a a film with the very awful name of Dairy Queens, a name that was sort of foisted on us by PBS because they thought it would be catchy and because the other two women were dairy farmers, and it was not. Her farm was at wheat and soybeans. But anyway, I'll show you that clip, and I'm going to then do also two more, one about another Lutheran church woman who became a disarmament activist that some of you may have known, and a final piece about three different individuals, three short pieces about different individuals who in quite different ways have tried to change our society. After each of these, please feel free to comment, ask questions, and add to the dialogue, and hopefully we'll be able to get these all into the hour.
If somebody can get the lights, this should come right on.
Breakfast is ready anytime.
Okay, I want to eat then, and so it'll be about 5 minutes.
Okay, we'll be ready.
Ann and Chuck Canton grow wheat, barley, soybeans, and sugar beets in western Minnesota. Three generations of Cantons have plowed this ground.
Good morning. Are you freezing?
Yes, it's cold.
Ann and Chuck know their land intimately and treat it with loving care. They hope their son Kent, the oldest of their three children, can keep farming here. The Cantons took the advice of experts who said expand for the coming boom in agriculture. They bought more land and bigger machines, but expansion was not the answer. They are hardworking, efficient, productive farmers, but they are going deeper into debt.
After farming on this farm for some over 20 years, Chuck and I looked at one another and realized, you know, there is something wrong. There is something wrong. Is it us? And are we just doing everything wrong on this place? Or what's happening to us in our small town and to some of our neighbors?
Seed, fuel, fertilizer, machinery, credit. The Cantons' costs have tripled in the past 10 years. They spend more than $6 to produce a bushel of wheat, but at harvest must sell it for less than $4. A few giant grain companies dominate the market. The only choice the Cantons have is to sell or wait, hoping for a higher price. But for them, farming is more than a business. It's a way of life. So even though their economic losses mount, they go deeper into debt, mortgaging their land for the cash to keep farming.
Not very long ago, Chuck had to go and borrow money to pay the interest on the borrowed money. And I know he looked at the banker and said, you know, you begin to wonder, you know, are we the only ones that are going through this? And the banker just laughed. And he said, there are many, many, many.
As long as land values rose, farmers survived. But land prices are falling now, and credit is drying up. Every week, more than 100 Minnesota family farms must sell out or face foreclosure. The Cantons know they are living on borrowed time.
$55, $50, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55, $55,
adoption is not easy for farmers to watch. In the past 30 years, they have said goodbye to more than half of their neighbors. But not since the Great Depression have so many auctions come so often. So many lives been changed forever. So many dreams died so suddenly.
Number 110, buddy.
It's just so wrong, I think, for this nation that expects all the abundance and all the good things in the supermarkets and in the stores, and yet that the people who are here and doing it and working the 12, the 14, maybe 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, can't make it.
Ourselves, and it's at the point where we have to do something, that we can no longer rely on the experts. If we want to survive on this land, it's up to the people of the land to do it.
They began to organize meetings, small at first, but larger as farmers heard that others were demanding a fair price and a living wage.
It just got more exciting, and we got to the point where we were organized enough to put together a march on the Capitol in St. Paul. I'd never protested bodily ever to say that I, as a farmer, was protesting. It was scary for me, but it was also terribly exciting. And the next step then was to say something nationally. We arrived at Washington early in the morning, found our way to Capitol Hill, finally found a place to park, walked for blocks, came around the corner of the Capitol of the United States and saw 40,000 farmers. I cried. Couldn't believe it. I remember I remember how good that was for Chuck. Because he grabbed me and he said, "We aren't the only ones."
I've been talking to them congressmen. I thought you know. I've been talking to them senators. Way down that road. Said, "I'm tired of all your lies, bribes, and poker ties. I've been doing some hard traveling alone."
A year later, in January 1979, they were back, this time with their tractors. They demanded federal policies that would guarantee a fair price for farm products and the survival of the family farm.
We found out that we could walk into senators' offices and congressmen's offices and we could talk to them. We knew what the issues were, and we could say it straight and strong and hopefully get them to understand. And of course, they didn't understand. But Moses had to go many times. It was the 10th time that Pharaoh finally agreed, and he said, "Go, take your people." Maybe it's unpredictable. Maybe something will happen. As long as we're still on the land, there's always a chance. And that's what we have to keep fighting for.
You know, some of the things she said are still, even though that film was made, came out 20 years ago this year, that many of the things almost feel like they're happening yesterday or happening right now, and they are. But Anne was an inspiration to me, and I know to many other people, and continues to be an inspiration. Both to farmers and to many of us who got involved in the farm movement at that time who weren't farmers at all, just supporters from the cities. Any comments or questions that anybody has about that particular segment?
Did you have to draw out of her that her faith was the driver in this, or was it something she expressed pretty clearly right up front?
Right up front. For Anne, this was very, very much a part of who she was. I mean, she was just a very active Lutheran. Her husband, I think very shortly afterwards, went to work for the ALC. Then the ALC in Minneapolis. They worked on, not only were they interested in the issues that affected them directly as small farmers on the land in Minnesota, but they had a great interest and compassion for hungry people all over the world, and they were involved in traveling to other countries trying to get support for things like, I think, Lutheran World Relief, other groups, to try to support the people on the land and people who were hungry and suffering all over. And I think the Cantons were huge inspiration for many, many people. And Anne did serve a very short period of time as Assistant Commissioner of Agriculture in Minnesota. But in Anne's case, and in the case of the next that woman you're going to see, faith was really central to her motivation as an activist and the courage that she got to go out and do something. I don't say it's always central. I have honestly met and done stories about people who have no faith at all and have done tremendous things simply out of pure idealism and another belief. But many of the people that I have seen do these kind of things come from this kind of strong faith conviction.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Meeker in Kandy, Ohio County, pastor, and I still deal with pastors, with farmers, with depression from that.
Well, I think things are still very...
Price a week still under $4. Mm-hmm. It's 20 years after you made the documentary, so...
Sure. And what's the rest of the...
Cost of production continues to go up, and the cost of the product is not budged at all.
It's really shocking. I mean, we do have an incredible cheap food policy in this country, which really comes out of the people who work on the land, not only the family farmers, but the farm workers, especially who we bring in to harvest the crops, and also in terms of all the impact on the environment from the chemicals and things like that, and on the people, which don't get figured in. Those health costs and everything which end up costing us in taxes and other things don't get added into the cost of food. And so, you know, we Americans pride ourselves on having such cheap food, but there's a huge cost for this to all of us and certainly to the people who grow the food. Yes?
One of the things she mentioned was that going to Washington, going to see congressmen, legislators, they didn't understand. I think until you've lived it, how do you relay that anxiety, the need, to people who have never lived it and don't understand? I think that's real difficult. They don't have a clue. And how do you relay that?
That's a good question, and one I wish I had met. Anybody have a good answer to that?
I worked with the Lutheran Office of Governmental Ministry in New Jersey and learned a little bit about advocacy through him, and I was through my supervisor. And one thing that really, two things I learned is, one, I guess I had this idealistic image of those in elected office as educated people that really, you know, when they went to vote on something, knew something about what they were voting. And it really is, you know, political, where it has a lot to do with what voices are in their head, of who's writing, who's calling, and, I mean, the effectiveness of the visits of the people. A handwritten letter from somebody who's going through a situation to a congressperson will get read much more than you get, you know, the... It really, I've seen it happen where somebody stands up and tells their story, their personal story, and people, congresspeople, can really be affected by that.
If they don't walk out of the room while you're trying to tell it.
Yeah. But it's the personal aspect. It impressed me more than I thought that they do listen. And the more, the stronger.
Well, and I think one thing it does show is the necessity for various groups of people who see change as being needing to come together and work together so that they can share the strength that they may not have as a single pressure group with the broad range of Congress. Any other questions? Otherwise, I'll go on to the next topic. Yes?
I also have a farmer I was talking to Monday about buying a corn stove, and he said, "Oh, you can't burn food." He was growing food, and yet even that industry is now making gasoline out of it. You know, it's giving him real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
How can he, as a person of faith, do that?
Yeah, I don't. Any other? The second story I want to show you a clip from actually happened right about at the same time, in fact, it was the same year that this film was finished, 1982, and I'm showing you some clips from my real early films here tonight as the week progresses. You'll see some from more contemporary films if you care to come back. Tomorrow we're doing a segment on the environment, on care for creation. We're going to be looking at simple living, simplicity at our harried and time-pressed society on Wednesday. Thursday we'll look at food, much more generally, the whole question of where our food comes from, how we can grow it differently, what cost we pay for it. And on Saturday we'll look at justice for the poor. So anyway, this next story, I had moved from Minneapolis to Seattle and was living in Seattle at that time and actually going back to Minnesota to finish the story about Ann Kent and the farm women. And when I was newly arrived in Seattle, the big issue out there was the fact the world's biggest and deadliest submarine, the Trident, was going to come into Puget Sound, and this would make the Seattle area sort of ground zero for a potential nuclear war. And there were a lot of concerns, both obviously about people not wanting to be the victims in a nuclear holocaust, but also not wanting to unleash this kind of weapon on anybody else. And there were fears that there were people at high levels in our government who might have that kind of thing in mind. So you had these sort of large demonstrations taking place against the Trident submarine coming. And this was a big national, even international issue that I wanted to look at as a filmmaker, because one of the things I feel is it's very important to take a story that maybe is local to you but has much larger ramifications. And this one, no question about it, it certainly did. And so the first idea I had was to go out and talk to some of the people at Ground Zero, which was a community of nonviolent activists who were protesting the submarine, and to maybe tell their stories, why they got motivated, why they were doing what they were doing. And I thought the people were terrific. They were really wonderful, committed, dedicated people, but I felt that they were much too both counterculture and in a sense purist to be able to speak to the broad American audience. I really felt that to put these folks on camera would be to preach to the converted, that the message would not go out through PBS to a wider audience that I wanted to reach, that they would be immediately written off as hippies and kind of, you know, troublemakers. And I was looking for a way to tell the story when an article appeared in the Seattle Tribune, Seattle Times, excuse me, about a, in the Minneapolis Tribune, the Seattle Times, I get the cities mixed up, even having lived in Seattle now for 20-some years, but about a woman, 78 years old, who was coming from where but Minnesota, Minneapolis, out to join her son in the Trident submarine protest. The 78-year-old woman had the intention of going out in a small boat with her son to block this submarine in an act of civil disobedience. It also said in the article that this woman was a very active woman in the Lutheran Church nationally, and that she had once been named National Mother of the Year for the United States. And some of you probably know her or have known her, and she died in 1984, but many people. And so, because I wanted to be fair and I'd done somebody from the ALC, this time it was someone from the LCA. So, all evened out if you're a Lutheran. And her name was Ruth Youngdahl Nelson. And did any of you know Ruth or know of Ruth?
No.
Ah, a lot more, okay, in this particular case. Again, very much a person acting out of faith. And so I called her son in Seattle and said, you know, I want to meet your mom when she gets out here and talk with her about being this, the story through which I tell the Trident submarine story to the public. And I met Ruth and, a couple of days later when she came out, and like everybody was totally captivated by this 78-year-old woman with so much, so articulate and terrific a person and so deeply committed to what she was about to do. And so she became the basis of a story about really the Trident Sub, but about her efforts, kind of the question, why does this incredibly straight church woman, you know, whose father and I think brother were Republican governor and a congressman and so forth, end up becoming so committed to the fight against nuclear arms that she's willing to do civil disobedience, possibly risking her life and certainly risking a jail sentence at the advanced age of 78. So I'm going to show you just the first part of this documentary, and then I want to let people know that some of these will be around. If it probably won't be too easy, but if people want to borrow them and look at the videos to see more there, we can probably arrange that. Oops,
sorry,
Manny, did you? Can't put one in without rejecting the other. Something I should have learned by now. Okay.
Surprises people when I tell them that I'm an accused felon. Of death, 2 football fields long, my friends, 4 stories high.
In the news, the nation's first Trident submarine, the Ohio, and her crew received a rousing welcome today to their home port of Bangor, Washington. Here, the Ohio will be armed with 24 missiles, each carrying multiple nuclear warheads. A deterrent force more deadly than the explosive power used in all of World War II.
The ship will see the country through the hard years ahead, providing strategic deterrent to nuclear war. It will do the job in magnificent fashion.
But earlier today, the Ohio met a different welcome from dozens of tiny protest boats attempting to block its path. It was a David and Goliath confrontation. The demonstrators were routed by water cannons and rifle-toting Coast Guardsmen. Among those arrested was a former American Mother of the Year.
If you marry your country, if you love your country, you'll say no. Even as if you love your child, you say no to something they ask for when it isn't good for them.
Young Dawn Nelson, an unlikely accused felon. She's 80 years old and the widow of a minister. One of her brothers was a governor. Another was a congressman. Only 10 years ago, she herself was honored as America's National Mother of the Year. But today, she's a lawbreaker, an outspoken critic of nuclear weapons. This is the story of an unusual woman and her remarkable family. Ruth was the 9th of 10 children born to Swedish immigrants, Elizabeth Youngdahl, and her husband, John, a Minneapolis grocer.
Our home was open to everybody. Hospitality was shown to peg leg John, who thumped down 11th Avenue each spring. And my mother would put a white tablecloth on the table and feed him as if he were a king.
Ruth first asserted her independent spirit here at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. As a student athlete, she starred in basketball, football, and tennis. Her accomplishments are still remembered.
It's my great pleasure to present to you the first woman inducted into the Gustavus Adolphus College Athletic Hall of Fame, Ruth Young Doll Nelson.
Today, a serious heart condition keeps Ruth off the basketball court, but she still gets plenty of exercise.
I swim each day and try to keep active as much as I can. Until 2 years ago, I water skied.
Ruth Young Doll met Clarence Nelson, a Lutheran minister, in a 3-mile swimming race. She won, and he proposed. In 1932, they were married. They had 4 children, and later adopted 3 others.
We've tried to teach by example. I remember one time when the boys were quarreling with a neighbor lady.
And my mother's response was to be to take a batch of brownies and send us down there with it, and as a kind of an offensive of goodwill in the face of all this hostility. And it was a tough assignment for us kids. We were not happy about it. But the amazing thing to us was to see how disarming the tactic that was.
Maybe there's people here who knew Ruth who can even add their personal observations, since obviously a lot of hands went up when I asked that. Otherwise, I'm again happy to answer any questions or take any comments that you have. Anybody?
How did she come to nuclear disarmament activism? The faith was always there, evidently. But the activism must have come, but there must have been some moment, or was it a more gradual thing?
Well, I think it was basically a gradual thing. I think that they were as a family very interested in the international relations. Their home was like a little United Nations. They always had all kinds of people visiting from different countries and things, and they took an interest in this. And again, I think her faith, as she understood it and took it seriously, was that the essence of being a Christian was to be a peacemaker, and that came out even with the story of the kids, sending the brownies. That idea was that you don't solve these things by adding more violence. I mean, as we clearly see today in the Middle East, that there's one blow and another blow, and things are obviously getting worse instead of better. And I think Ruth understood those things. Her son also, I think, had a big influence because he was out there in that area. He had been involved. He was very concerned, very convinced, I think, that Trident was a potential first strike weapon, and that indeed was going even way beyond, it was a peacemaker anyway, but a defensive weapon was one thing, but something that really could be seen as something in order to get, to make the first strike in a nuclear war, that just really, for John, that was just something he couldn't abide. And I think he had a lot of influence on his mother. She wanted to be there with him and with that family. He also adopted, 10 kids or something like that. A terrific family. And interestingly, one of Clarence Nelson's parishioners in the church that they were in out in Washington, D.C., was a fellow named Bruce Langan, who we look at in the film later. Bruce was the leader of the U.S. delegation to Iran and the leader of the group of American hostages in Iran in 1979. And when I met him, this was not too long after he'd been released and had come back from Iran and was actually the president of the U.S. Army War College in D.C. But still, a friend of Ruth. By then, Ruth's husband had died. And so I interviewed him, and Bruce Langan, of course, disagreed with Ruth about the submarine and the defense issue and so forth. But the one thing he said was, he absolutely had to respect her because her convictions were so deep and they were so clearly not self-interested, but because she had done a lot of thinking about it, and that he hoped that in some way, certainly even though he disagreed with her about the specifics of the Trident submarine, that her actions would help lead the world toward peace.
Do you know if up here in the mountains?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sometimes hard for me with the lights to know who's speaking.
You want me to turn the lights on up here?
It's okay.
There's a group in Minneapolis, Women Against Military Madness, mm-hmm. WAM, the old acronym. Was she involved with that group at all? Are you aware?
My memory, and this is a while ago, because this film was made almost, first shot, the Trident submarine protest was virtually 20 years ago, almost next week. I mean, so it's 20 years ago next week that scene occurred with Ruth out in the boat in the Trident submarine. So my memory's a little hazy, but I do think she had some connection with the women who formed that group. Others of you may know far better than I.
There's a Roman Catholic sister or nun who recently was in prison for a civil protest in Georgia, at Fort Benning.
Oh, at the College of the Americas.
Yes. From Minneapolis.
Yeah, very, very many people of faith have gone there and actually been arrested in protesting the School of the Americas, as it's called, which has really been responsible for training many Latin American military officers in torture and other unfortunate.
Up here, John. I just met Ruth a couple of times, but I knew her son John quite well, being involved with him and others in Seattle in the early 80s in a work called Target Seattle. And part of what I loved about seeing this is that it's so telling how activism runs in a family and can get passed from generation to generation. One of my godchildren was nannied by one of John's daughter-in-laws, who also had 11 children, many of them international. So at least three generations in that family of really caring about the world. And I find it moving as a parent myself to ask those kinds of questions. How do you live with your children in such a way that the best of what you believe in and work for gets passed down to them somewhere? Because her son John is quite a force in himself. And my guess is he's been up here at some point. Some of us know. John Nelson, has he been up the whole room?
I would be surprised if he hadn't, too.
I'd be very surprised if he hadn't been up here.
That's a great point. And in fact, there's a whole session going on that I read here about that very issue.
Yes.
That Marcia Bungie is teaching. In fact, in the discussion today, which I was at, I was talking about how what we actually do as parents, more than just what we say, influences our kids and what they become and what they take on and how these moral values are passed on. No question that they were passed on in the young doll Nelson family.
Just a quick anecdote. Dan Erlander made the point last week that when John went to serve at Central Lutheran in Seattle, he made an arrangement with the parish leadership that part of his vacation day vacation time would include jail time, that would be built into his contract.
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, John, and he lived up to it. I know on more than one occasion in which John went to jail.
That's
so
right.
And Ruth didn't. Ruth was, you know, she was out in the boat, faced the things, was arrested and everything, but the judge kind of ended up throwing it out of court, so she didn't go to jail. And we made this, the film was finished only a very short time before Ruth died. And that was one of the great things for, she had cancer. And one of the great things for me was that she was able to see the film before she died, and that the whole family watched it with her for the first time. And shortly before it was on public television. In fact, we were able to dedicate it to her before it got on TV, because she actually died before the broadcast. The third clip that I'm going to show from the film is from a program I did called It's Up to Us. And I made this show a little bit later. This was about 1988. And I'd done these different stories about people of courage who'd stood up for their convictions. And I think in 1987, I actually found out about an organization based on Whidbey Island in Washington State here that honored people just like that, and in fact had stories of hundreds of people who were kind of the Ruth Nelsons of their communities, maybe not to that degree, but also had shown courage. And the organization was called the Giraffe Project because it honored people who stuck their necks out for the common good. And they had some great stories, and I ended up doing a PBS documentary about this organization and its work. And I'm going to show you a little section of the documentary with the three of the giraffes profiled. These are very short profiles. The first is a doctor, and a doctor that you've probably heard of, and some of you may have seen Robin Williams playing his part in Patch Adams. I had a chance to spend some time with Patch Adams, who is nothing at all like Robin Williams. I had a lot, I mean, I liked that movie, but I had some big problems with it, knowing the real Patch Adams. The second is actually a completely different thing. It's a person whose courage was to bring music to her community, and that wasn't the kind of stick your neck out thing. And then the third is the story of a Catholic priest who really risked his life in fighting the Aryan Nations racist group in northern Idaho in the late 1980s. And Father Bill Wasmuth, who is unfortunately has very, very short time to live. He's now in Seattle and has been working for a human rights organization for a number of years. I saw a piece about him recently in the paper that Bill won't be with us for long, but he was a very inspirational fellow to me. So these are, this is from It's Up to Us. Yes.
Thank you.
James.
Aren't seeking advice, they're sharing stories about people like Patch Adams.
Push! Emergency! Take one of these and swallow it at least three times a day. If you have trouble swallowing it, just put it in your mouth like this. And you'll feel a lot better.
Laughter is the best medicine, he says.
Right.
Dr. Patch Adams is a respected physician who believes America's medical system needs radical surgery.
Medicine has become a business, and a very big business. No longer is it perceived as a service-oriented part of the community, but a part of the community where a person can make a lot of money.
Not so for Patch. Until recently, he and several associates offered free medical care to anyone in need.
We used our home for 12 years. We, the staff, worked irregular part-time jobs to pay to help other people.
Financially, their combination home and hospital was a shaky operation.
We have over 1,000 foundation rejections. We have never been able to even remotely interest the state, county, or federal government in any of our work.
But as word about their work spread, people everywhere responded.
Every single state sends us money. We get $1 checks. We get boxes of used sheets from people saying, I know you'll need some sheets.
Today, Patch Adams and his friends have taken temporary leave of medical practice.
Come here and get the same feeling.
Here in the hills of West Virginia, they're building a dream. A free hospital where doctors and patients will live and work together in a healing community. Patch calls it the Gesundheit Institute.
We chose the name Gesundheit because it makes people laugh. There's an atmosphere thing that we're trying to create that is happy, funny, loving, cooperative, and creative. And of all of those things, if you don't have humor around human suffering, it will burn you out.
Yes, sirs and madams, I'm Dr. Niederman, and I'm the genuine representative of Not Quite the Answer products.
Patch also believes doctors ought to be as concerned about preventing illness as they are about treating it. Using humor, he teaches people about healthy living. He calls it his traveling medicine show, and he plays to appreciative crowds all across the country.
You walk on over to your teeth, and you brush them, holding the brush at a 45-degree angle between the teeth and the gum line.
Patch Adams is sticking his neck out to improve our healthcare system, and the medical profession is paying attention.
Medical students, nurses, they hear about our work and they're overwhelmingly supportive. We represent the dream for people. Greed has infected our society. It is the worst infection. And we are a pie in the face of greed. We are taking the most expensive thing in America and giving it away for free.
I forgot there's actually one other short segment in here that I didn't mention to you, and you'll see it now.
Meet with a national board, potential donors, and celebrity volunteers.
This is Candace Bergen for the Giraffe Project, urging you to stick your neck out for the things you care about. Let's just do one more.
Hey, this is take two, 2 minutes.
Are you a giraffe? There's so much that's wrong and that needs help these days that I think you have to do whatever you can, and I really support a project that that has private people going out and doing what needs doing.
There are kids there cheering them on.
Advertisers also help publicize giraffe stories. These volunteers are considering a television spot about a very special place. Kids at Fort Apache Youth Center is a haven in a heartless world. It's a place where kids from poor families find pride in themselves, athletic activity, and academic tutoring that keeps them in school.
Need this, we've been here to answer the question.
George Hankins, a former Army boxing champion, has been helping young people here since he started this center 15 years ago. Back then, George was a policeman. His beat was a district called Fort Apache, the Bronx, one of the poorest and toughest neighborhoods in America.
You could pick up drugs on the any corner, just like you could at Cornell Candy School. It was nothing to have 5, 6, 7 homicides a week. If you want somebody wiped out, no problem. Those guys would do you in for a pack of cigarettes almost, you know.
One day while on patrol, George broke up a gang fight. He took on 2 gang leaders with one hand behind his back and flattened them both. The kids made George an offer. Teach us to box like that and we'll disband the gangs. George Hankins gave it a try. But his fellow patrolman didn't think teaching kids to fight better was such a hot idea.
At first, I got more harassment from my co-workers than I did from anybody in the street.
Then a former gang member came to the aid of the cop and George's efforts were vindicated. George Hankins and George Pearson, another officer, used their personal savings to establish this youth center. They set up athletic and academic programs, but eventually their savings dried up.
Mutual of New York, King County, finished paying off mortgage for us. Plus they got our taxes, their status and everything in place, and we started rolling really from there.
Some former youth center members have become boxing champions. Others are lawyers, doctors, and business people. And the streets of Fort Apache have gotten safer.
The crime rate as far as people that are involved in the Fort Apache youth center has gone way down. It's gone way, way down.
For a lot of kids, a giraffe named George is offering a new look at life.
I tell our kids, you can discipline yourself to do boxing. You can discipline yourself to put yourself through a strenuous exercise program like boxing demands. And you can discipline yourself for that. Piece of cake, and get hustle. A piece of cake.
Chamber music is a far cry from boxing, but Olga Bloom has a lot in common with George Hankins. She saw a need, took a risk, and made a difference.
I'm trying to make clear my passion for installing small excellences as part of a community for the enrichment of all.
On the Brooklyn waterfront sits a former coffee barge, which is now a music hall. When Olga Bloom retired as a concert violinist, she didn't retire from writing.
In fact, it never stops. We go all year.
She felt America needed more intimate settings where people could experience fine art and get to know the artists.
I was thinking of perhaps corporate foyers, you know, those vast spaces. I thought they could stand a bit of humanizing.
But when Olga saw an old barge advertised for sale, she thought it might be just the place she had in mind. Olga mortgaged her home to buy the barge, then used her savings and her own hands to refinish the interior. But when she looked for a place to moor it, officials said the barge didn't meet city codes.
The hazards were enormous. I had no idea of bureaucratic tangles, but in the beginning days, as I labored very hard, all the working men on the waterfront came to my aid. Whenever I started, people came to help me.
Olga Bloom still works on the barge every day, bringing a little corner of heaven to a dock in Brooklyn.
Okay, ready for business.
People from all walks of life come here to enjoy some of the finest music in the world at the lowest price in New York. All income goes to expenses. Olga lives on a pension. City like New York or a small town, but all giraffes take a risk, and sometimes the risk is life.
This is my body, which will be given up for you.
Father Bill Wasmuth lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's a Western resort town, small, friendly, and traditional. few years ago, the peace and quiet here was shattered. They came to northern Idaho calling for an all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest. The Aryan Nations, a racist organization, made Coeur d'Alene its headquarters.
Initially, the community reaction was to just let them be, live and let live, that kind of a philosophy. But then we found out very quickly that such inaction was interpreted by both the Aryans and by the rest of the country as being tacit support, if not active support.
When Aryans began harassing minorities in Coeur d'Alene, concerned citizens formed a task force to defend human rights. As leader of the task force, Father Bill became the symbol of resistance to racism.
I thought that we would be safe because the Aryans would figure out that if they attacked any of us at all, that it would just galvanize the community against them. Unfortunately, we gave them too much credit for thinking.
In 1986, a series of bombings rocked the town of Coeur d'Alene. The first bomb went off here, Bill Wasmuth's house. If he'd been in his kitchen instead of his living room, it might have killed him.
I will consider it carefully well.
Bill was afraid, but he refused to back down.
I stayed in my house that night, and I stayed in my house the next night and never left. The community was watching very much on how I responded to this thing, and if I responded in a great deal of fear, they would end up with a lot of fear and panic as well, and I didn't want that to happen.
It didn't happen. The citizens of Coeur d'Alene rallied around Father Bill and the task force, leaving the Aryans alone and defeated.
People really are, their hearts are in the right place on this issue. The community is very anxious to be a model community in terms of openness to all peoples of all races, creeds, and colors. Make a difference in your world.
So we've got just a few more minutes here. Are there any questions about any of those particular stories?
This can help in thinking of
West. Pardon me?
This can help in thinking that West Creek was kind of a giraffe. This place.
You can probably think of quite a few of them. You can give your own awards. Yeah, I was talking about the Patch Adams story, and some of you saw the movie. I think that the movie, you had a little trouble understanding why he was, I mean, it almost seemed like the Robin Williams character was sort of able to win these patients over by just being goofy. But the real Patch Adams wasn't quite the way it, as you could see, he is. I mean, Patch Adams is still very much alive and very active. The real Patch Adams as you saw, a juggler, tightrope walker, spent a little time with the Flying Karamazov brothers. And he would actually go in and do this sort of stuff, and, you know, which Robin Williams, I simply wasn't able to do as an actor to perform that, but he would go in and do all these kinds of crazy gymnastics and things like that, and not just say goofy things. And I think that was part of getting these, picking up the mood and spirits of the patients. And I'm glad that movie was made, and I think it had a very positive and uplifting message, but it was kind of a far cry from who Patch Adams actually is.
Do you have the clip on the Japanese film?
No, that tape was missing when I left home. I know that I put that down on the thing. And also, originally the time was going to be longer, so I had to cut something, and I thought that being from World War II, that these other things were maybe more contemporary. So I don't have that with me, the Gordon Hirabayashi story. But if you don't know what's being referred to. There was a couple. I did two films I've done two films in my career on the subject of the internment of Japanese Americans and taken from their homes on the West Coast during the Second World War and sent to these basically concentration camps throughout the Intermountain West for the duration of the war. And the first one I did was about the evacuation of Bainbridge Island, which is, for those of you who don't know, right across the Sound from Seattle. It's about 8 miles from Seattle. It was the first place to be evacuated on the West Coast, and it was a test case. Basically, the idea was if the Japanese Americans go peacefully here, then we can kind of probably do it all over. And it was also the only place on the West Coast where the local newspaper actually editorialized and spoke out against the internment. And it's kind of the story behind, the real story behind snow falling on cedars. In fact, there are some scenes in the, my documentary was actually shown to the entire cast of Snow Falling on Cedars when they were making the movie. And the Sam Shepard character in that movie in reality was a fellow named Walt Woodward, who was the editor of the Bainbridge Island newspaper, and who was the only one out of the West Coast who really stuck his neck out for the Japanese Americans and said, you know, this is wrong, this is something that should not be done, this is a violation of the Bill of Rights, and so forth. Walt died only recently, and one of the middle schools on Bainbridge Island is named for him. The second internment story I did was about the life of Gordon Hirabayashi, who was a student at the University of Washington when the war broke out, and he was one of only three Japanese Americans who themselves actually resisted the internment. And his resistance came very much from faith. He was a very strong Quaker, raised in a Quaker family, and Gordon succeeded some 40 years later in getting the Supreme Court to overturn his conviction and to state that, in fact, the internment itself was unconstitutional, what had happened. And Gordon is still a very active fellow. He must be about 85 now. I'm not sure exactly, but I think he was born in 1917, so he should be about 85 now, and he lives up in Edmonton, Alberta, where he taught sociology for many years, and still a very, very outspoken person about the civil rights of everyone.
Mm-hmm. How do you find promoting these kind of documentaries is accepted in the media? Are people willing to purchase them or promote them as well as, I mean, we see so much negative?
Well, it's I think it's tough sometimes. I've been fairly lucky and successful in getting these programs shown nationally on public television. So in that sense, I've been fortunate. But I think it's tough. I mean, even our own. And I don't know what the situation is like in other cities, but our own critics, for instance, in the Seattle newspapers, the TV critics, one of whom was a very good friend of mine, will say that sometimes they would like to do stories about these things, and the people above them will say, no, we want you to cover the latest thing in Friends, or you know, in one of the whatever or we want you to make a call and interview this or that actress or something like that. Instead, nobody pays attention to these documentaries anyway. But I think they do try. I think that most of the TV critics are actually looking for these kind of things and try to be supportive. But sometimes their editors overrule them. So. In honesty, the audiences for these programs are small. They're not as small as maybe if they were on cable access or something, but they're really roughly anywhere from 2 to 4% of the U.S. TV viewing audience who would see something that I do. And some of these films don't go much farther. Now, the film I'm showing later this evening, if you haven't seen it and have the time and want to see it, called Affluenza, is probably the exception to that rule. That particular program got a great deal of press coverage. New York Times, People Magazine, all kinds of things. Had quite good ratings for public television and has been used tremendously all over since then. Andy Warhol talks about, you know, the 15 minutes of fame. This was sort of after 25-year career, it's kind of my mini hit that got some attention. Most of the rest of them went out into the ozone. But that one seemed to strike a chord. Yes?
Do you hope that AppLens is something that you can use to continue exposure of topics like this that people really should be watching?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's certainly, for me, it's been a big help in terms, again, of getting other things on the air and things, because all the PBS programmers know that show, and they all got good responses. So, you know, if I have something, the odds of it getting carried on stations are good because they know about Affluenza. And it's also allowed me to do a lot of speaking and a lot of radio and a lot of other kinds of things in which I can bring in many of these sort of issues. And it turned into a book as well. And one of the things you find is that even though you do an immense amount of research to make a TV show, TV is superficial. It will always be superficial. If one can do anything with it, hopefully, what you can do is inspire people to want to go farther. But I wrote a book, Affluenza, and suddenly that made me more take it a little more seriously, even though it didn't require any more research. And so I got a lot more speaking and radio invitations as a result of the book.
Thank you, sir. We have to go to chapter.
Yes.